It was Halle Berry. Thanks to her, we were invited by the guys to their show and backstage afterward. Even my dad, who I hadn't heard from in a while, called to say he'd seen me on TV and that he was very proud of his little girl. It was a surprise because my dad didn't reach out often. If we spoke on the phone, it was because I called. If I saw him and his family in New York, it was because I was the one who visited him. He asked what Tony Danza was like and could I get pictures. Then he said, why don't you make a movie with Marty Scorsese? He's from the old neighborhood. Well, I love you, Dad, I said, but I don't have his phone number. He said, well, get it somehow. Don't you have an agent? I said, hey, Dad, you know it's not easy to get on a series, right? My mother was genuinely proud of me. She always thought I was funny. She used to say, oh my God, Leah, you make me laugh all the time. But now I was on television, making other people laugh. I was on top of the world. My family was proud. My church was proud. I was on my way. In television, however, there's a thing called ratings, and we didn't do well in them. And we were told that we were being canceled. We were all completely devastated. None of us were ready to move on. We had just gotten started. After shooting the 12th episode of Living Dolls in December 1989, we had a wrap party, which was the worst thing I could ever imagine. On top of the sadness I felt to be leaving this group of people I had become so close to so quickly, I had no idea what I was moving on to. I was worried about making the payments on my brand new car and paying the rent on the apartment filled with all matching furniture that I had convinced my family I could afford. To my mom and George, I pretended that everything was going to be all right, but on the inside, I was dying from the pressure. I didn't understand why I was being punished. What had I done? Chapter 7. You're not going to do this show, my agent said. Not going to do this show? It was Saved by the Bell. I was now with a big power agency, ICM, which I had been encouraged to move to after I got Living Dolls. Still, I didn't care how big and powerful these guys were. I was grateful that a popular sitcom was offering me 6 episodes and I was going to take it. My agent's rationale for turning down the role of Stacy Carosi, who has a romance with Zach, played by Mark Pearl Gosler, was that since I was coming off of a series, it was beneath me to take a recurring role on a show. I thought, not having money to pay my rent is beneath me. The series that I had just come off of in the fall of 1991, The Man and the Family, lasted for only 7 episodes. It left me back where I was before Dolls, auditioning for guest appearances on popular sitcoms. I just wanted to belong somewhere again, on a show I could call my own. I was exhausted already. I did a pilot. It didn't go any further. I got another series. It got canceled before it aired. Each time I swore I was going to give up, but then I'd just get back up and keep going. All told, I've been on more than 25 eventually canceled television shows in my career, and have appeared in even more pilots that never made it to air. While I would never complain, I certainly did feel anxiety. This is not an easy business to be in. It seemed like all the actresses in L.A. were going out for the same roles. After a few rounds of endless auditions at the studios, I was able to identify the girls who were my competition for these coveted spots. So, when I walked into an audition for the part of Rhea Perlman's daughter on Cheers and saw one of my regular contenders, I was like, ugh, there's Aniston. Jennifer Aniston and I had become friendly from seeing each other so much at various auditions. She was normal, unlike most other actresses who, if you tried to make small talk, like asking where they were from, would accuse you of trying to psych them out. One girl I tried to shoot the shit with got up and walked out. So when you find someone like Jennifer, who isn't douchey, you develop a natural camaraderie. When I saw her in the last round of callbacks for the Cheers audition, I said, fuck, I hope you don't get this one. I need to pay my rent. Jennifer just smiled and said, I hope you get it then. The part of Carla's daughter was kind of a no-brainer for me, but you never know. So when the casting agent came out and said, Jennifer, I was thinking, oh my God, you gotta be fucking kidding me. But the agent finished the sentence with, thank you so much, but we're going to go with Leah this time. Jennifer couldn't have been sweeter. Congratulations, honey, she said. And I could tell she really meant it. My first day on the set of Cheers, I was totally awestruck because it was such a huge show and it featured major Emmy-winning actors. While I was watching rehearsal, Ted Danson came and sat next to me. I tried to play it cool, not wanting to bother him, so when he said, would you run lines with me, I assumed he was speaking to someone else and completely ignored him. Is that too much, he said. I'm sorry, were you talking to... I actually didn't know, I stammered. I heard you, I just didn't know if you were talking to me. Yes, darling, I'm talking to you. Would you mind? I'm so bad on my lines. Of course, I said. We went through his lines, and when he did the scene for real, I felt completely responsible for his success, like I was Ted Danson's acting coach or something. So, I had landed the role of Carla's daughter on Cheers, but of course, as TV history would tell, Jennifer Aniston got hers with Friends. When the show was still being developed and was called Friends Like Us, I tried out for the part of Monica. As soon as my agent and I read the script, we knew it was going to be a hit. And it was filming over at Warner Brothers, right across the hall from John Levy's office. If this wasn't meant to be, I didn't know what was. The way it worked back then was you'd go to the studio first to audition, and then if you made the cut, you went to the network. If you didn't make it, you would get the "it's not going any further" line, but if you did go on, it was a long day. It came down to me and this other girl at network. We became friendly during what seemed like an eternity of them asking us individually to go in and read, then sit outside, then calling one of us back in, then out, and so on. Eventually, the cast director came out and said, "Thank you so much." Here was the embarrassing part, where one of us would exit a failure. It's hard to walk out with your head held high when you've been rejected. "You can both leave," the cast director said. We were surprised, but relieved. The girl and I assumed they were going to tell us at home who got the part, which was probably for the best. We walked out of the building into the completely empty parking lot. It was a Saturday, so no one was at the studio. We chatted on the way to our cars, wishing each other the best, and then we saw Courtney Cox walking towards us, then past us, and right into the building. Motherfucker! We both knew it right away. She had the part of Monica. I knew Friends was going to be a hit. This killed me. I cried for days. I swore I would never audition for another show, ever, because this had been the one that was going to be my ticket. This one was so tough to get over. In addition to hustling for parts, I had all my Scientology work to deal with. I was a dedicated parishioner, going through auditing and courses, but still there were always things required as a parishioner that I felt uncomfortable with, like the drills we had to do on certain courses. One was to spot different levels on the tone scale. You had to stop complete strangers on Hollywood Boulevard, get them to answer questions, and then assess their tone. 2.5 for boredom, 0.07 for hopeless, and so on. As part of a course on the tone scale, we were sent out with clipboards and required to pretend that we needed people to answer questions for a survey being conducted by the Hubbard Such and Such Research Center. But it was all just a ruse for us to practice assessing different tone levels. The surveys weren't real. Most people were like, "Fuck you, I know who you are and what you're doing." I took a shortcut to try to get out of doing the drill. "I'm an actress. I can't be out there. Someone might recognize me from my not-so-popular and canceled series," I protested. "John Travolta did it," the supervisor said. "You're going to do it." I was pretty much always on course a minimum of 2.5 hours a day at the Celebrity Center on Franklin Avenue, which was the building reserved for people in the arts or their associates to get services. After I became a working actress, I always went in through the main entrance, but there was a special one that led to the president's office, a private area reserved exclusively for celebrities like John Travolta, Tom Cruise, and Kirstie Alley, and other VIPs. I didn't get that role on Friends, so I wasn't there yet. In the theory room of the course room, which is just for reading, I would sit as still as a statue because a supervisor was always walking around looking for manifestations of study problems. If someone scratched his head, the supervisor would come over and ask, "What word don't you understand here?" I always tried my best not to blink or breathe. If you yawned, you were pretty much dead in the water. "Get your course pack and come into the practical room for a checkout on your materials," the supervisor would command. Being checked out sent me directly back to elementary school, where teachers seemed to take sadistic pleasure in pointing out a kid's gap in understanding in front of everyone in the class. In quizzing me, the supervisor asked for definitions of words in the course packet, then examples of how to use those words in a sentence, sometimes starting at the top of the page, which read Sussex, England, and if you didn't know where that was, you'd have to reread the whole thing again. Sussex was where L. Ron Hubbard once had a home and is now the highly coveted Church of Scientology called St. Hill Manor. They went back as much as 10 pages in the course to find something I had forgotten. It could be the third point in the 10 points of keeping Scientology working, or reciting verbatim all 12 antisocial personality attributes. Then I would have to go all the way back in my course to that point. It was frustrating, but the objective was to get the correct data and technology per HCOB, Hubbard Communications Office Bulletin. That meant doing it exactly right. I mean, exactly. Being on course was time-consuming, but when a parishioner was getting audited, there was no time limit. An auditing session could be 20 minutes or 20 hours. As determined by L. Ron Hubbard policy, you were expected to do 12 and a half hours a week of auditing or study. If you were not a good student before Scientology, you certainly would become one. Auditing is all about rooting out hidden pain, stress, or anxiety with the use of an e-meter and then getting rid of it. The e-meter, short for electropsychometer, is an electronic instrument that measures mental state and change of state in individuals, according to the church. During the process, the pre-clear, or PC, person getting the auditing, is asked a set of questions or given directions as he holds on to two empty cans hooked up to the meter. It is believed that the thoughts in a person's mind affect the flow of energy between the cans and cause the needle on the dial to move. When you're being interviewed by the auditor, there's a mental image picture. This is a Scientology term for something you can see in your mind, most often demonstrated by asking someone to close their eyes and think of a cat, and then describe what it looks like. These mental image pictures include emotion, pain, or stress, which changes the flow of the current and moves the needle. The auditor's job is to keep the session focused by using the meter and observing the reactions on the needle. There are 28 needle characteristics that auditors have to know verbatim. A little shaky movement on the dial means you're having a bad thought about the thing you are talking about, or about something you're not telling the auditor. If the needle falls to the right, it tells the auditor to pursue what the PC is thinking about or talking about. This is one of the hardest parts about being in session. There might be something you really want to get off your chest or understand better, a fight with a boyfriend, problems with your mother, an issue with a colleague at work. But if the needle doesn't move when you talk about a particular subject, you have to move on. In Scientology, you further discuss only what's reading on the meter. Auditing can also become a form of self-editing when it comes to criticizing others. The theory in Scientology is that if you are critical of someone, you have similar transgressions of your own. For example, if you were to say, "My boyfriend beats me," that would be seen as saying something critical to the auditor. He would then turn it around and say, "I got that, but have you done something similar to him or others?" The word critical in Scientology is very different. Hubbard defined critical thought as a symptom of an overt act having been committed or a withhold from an auditor. What Hubbard meant is that critical thought is a bad thing. It indicates a criminal act. Overt acts and withholds are the equivalent of crimes against life and freedom in Scientology. The new definition thus makes it a crime for members to think critically, particularly about Scientology. Any critical thought by the Scientologist is immediately suspect. This redefinition makes criticizing anything about Scientology extremely difficult for members, as it is reflected back on them as something they did wrong. Hubbard's message is clear. Critical thought is not the sort of thing any good Scientologist should be engaged in. As a result, you start to edit what's happened to you in your mind, and thus you can fail to address what's bothering you because you know we'll end up all coming back to what you did to provoke the situation. There are also other problems that can get in the way of covering those items that might be bothering you in your life. Scientology auditing follows a precise series of steps. Each addresses one or more conditions that everyone supposedly needs to overcome. Thus, your auditor directs your problems as required for you to move up the bridge. For example, the steps on the bridge predetermine what will be addressed next. The auditor would then say, "In looking at earlier interviews and auditing, I have found that in your life you have a problem with communication." Your auditor then proceeds to ask, "From where could you talk to your mother?" You give various answers, but the auditor continues to come back again and again. Looking for more answers, you grow frustrated and exhausted as the auditor comes back to you with the same question dozens of times, trying to unblock you. Then you surrender. You have a realization that gets the required reaction on the e-meter that signifies this step is complete with a floating needle. You finally say, I can communicate with my mother from anywhere. In the end, the ability gained is that you can communicate with anyone on any subject. Through auditing, it has been proven unequivocally that you did indeed have this problem, but just were not aware of it. And now that it's been proven to you that you did have a problem with communication, and that problem has now been eliminated. At the end of every session, once the needle has floated, the auditor says, thank you very much. Your needle is floating. We're going to end session now. You now leave feeling that you've accomplished something. Didn't know that was there, but now I'm clear of it. But the mindfuck lies in the fact that they assigned you the problem and not the other way around. And afterward, if you realize that you still have a problem communicating with your mother, you are taught that that person is a WOG or downtone. Being downtone means existing at the lower level of the Scientology tone scale, which is a listing of the various emotional states you can be in. The higher you are on the tone scale, the happier and healthier you are. So if you're downtone, it means you're unhappy and unhealthy and potentially dragging higher tone people down with you. The process could produce a great sense of cathartic relief. Here was a problem I wasn't even aware of, that I may have created for myself. And after much back and forth, I was able to overcome that problem. So while in session, I would feel the euphoria of self-discovery and growth, back in the real world, I was still angry, depressed, and judgmental. Looking at my diaries from that period, journaling was frowned upon by the church, but I did it anyway, I would note that I still wanted more from my life and my family's life. My Scientology realizations were great in the church building, but I would start cursing when I couldn't find my car in the parking lot or when I had no money left in my bank account. It just wasn't there for me in real-life situations, the sense of accomplishment of having solved problems. It really existed only when I was in the presence of other Scientologists who completely bought into it. What I didn't realize at the time was that all the understanding I gained through auditing only related back to my life in the church and helped me be a Scientologist. My gains in Scientology were not relating to the real world. I was so entrenched in the church that had become my everything. I couldn't question that. Chapter 8. When it came to men, I never really dated Scientologists, even though it was encouraged. I was embarrassed by a lot of people in the church who didn't pay attention to practical things like how they looked and who talked in a language that was strange to the outside world. Just like I wanted a normal mom as a kid, now I wanted a normal boyfriend. Dating outside the church also probably meant there was a part of me that was subconsciously trying to keep something for myself that wasn't connected to Scientology. Most of my family was in the church, as were most of my friends, and I spent much of my free time on course or being audited. My romantic life gave me that tiny bit of freedom away from the weight of saving the planet. My fantasy was that I'd meet a regular, cool, normal guy who wasn't a Scientologist but was open to it. Hopefully fucked up enough to desperately need it. Looking back now, I'm sure that the way my father acted and the way I perceived him ultimately informed the way I looked at men both when I was growing up and as an adult. I interpreted his yelling and his dominance as strength, and I ultimately adopted the same behavior and took it on as part of my own persona. I believed this was the way a man was supposed to be, and this was how a woman felt by being charmed by him. He yells, she cowers. To me, this all made sense, except that in my relationships, I was usually the one doing the yelling. I treated men badly and didn't have much respect for them. I had a list of very specific things that could get a man written off my list pretty fast, including, for example, men who wear sandals. Shallow, I know. Always a keen observer since childhood, I also kept a mental list of what I thought a man was. Men say horrific and hurtful things to their wives and daughters and are forgiven. Men are strong, women weaker, or men appear strong, but they are weak. Men are charming. Men wear cologne. Men get manicures. Men have clean cars. Men cheat. Men don't care about their families. Men go and start new families. Men hurt women. Men do not value anything. Men break their word and women forgive them. Men appear to be the dominant species. Men win. From the age of 18 through 25, I went through a very promiscuous period, going out with all kinds of guys, from gorgeous soap actors to athletic beach bums. But I was never really attached to anyone in particular. It was mainly sex without any emotional connection. Now look, I don't want to give the idea that I would sleep with anyone. I wasn't picking up random men and bringing them home. I just wasn't faithful. And sex was a substitute for really being there in a relationship. I would do things that men would normally do to women to get back at them. But I was only hurting myself. If I had sex with a guy afterward, I would say things like, listen, I have a very early morning, so you have to go. You can't sleep here. Or, I have to go now. Haven't been home all day and my dog has to be let out. I didn't have a dog. I would do this to a guy before he could do it to me. If I spent the night or committed to them, I would be made vulnerable. I was convinced that they would eventually either cheat or leave me anyway. Why open myself up to another man breaking my heart? My mom always wanted me to be with someone in the church, because she thought it would help me with my problems with men and intimacy in general. I don't know, Ma, I just don't respect men, I confessed to her. I have bad intentions towards them. Obviously, it comes from Dad and Dennis. I want to break their hearts like my heart's been broken, having been let down by many of the men in my life. I never want them to get the upper hand. Even if I feel something for them, I tell them to get the hell out. But like any good Scientologist, my mom offered answers that led directly back to the church. You'll handle that in session, she said, and that was it. She didn't judge me, and for that, she's always the person I go to, then and now. She subscribed to the idea that anything bad I was doing wasn't really the doing of her daughter. Instead, it was my reactive mind, which I was on the road to dealing with and getting rid of. The main thing was that I stay on course and move up the bridge. If I did that, everything would sort itself out. All of my non-Scientology boyfriends would tell me I was fucked up and that clearly Scientology was not working for me because I kept cheating or leaving. This made me go in search of someone even more fucked up than I was. Someone I could fix to avoid fixing myself. In 1996, the universe provided me with Angelo Pagan, a man with a history of cheating and three kids. Perfect. Now I'll preface this by saying this is not a love story. I mean, it's a story about love, just not the kind that you hope to tell your kids one day. It all began with a WB sitcom I was on, First Time Out, which naturally was soon canceled. The show's star, Jackie Guerra, who became a good friend, invited me to a Cuban nightclub to celebrate getting canceled. I wasn't exactly feeling celebratory about being on the unemployment line yet again, but when I heard that Scott Baio, who had directed the last episode of our show, was going to be there, I quickly said, yes. Maybe I'd marry Scott. He might make this better. There was no doubt about it. I wanted Charles in charge of me, and Chachu Loves Leah sounded kind of nice. Now that he was no longer my director in a professional relationship, maybe there was something there. As soon as I walked into the Cuban club El Floridita, I fell in love with the place. It was the tiniest nightclub I'd ever been to in my life. A small parquet dance floor surrounded by tables, a drop ceiling, red walls, and strung up Christmas lights were the sum total of El Floridita's decor. After Jackie, Scott, and I had dinner, the band started playing salsa music, and soon after that, this guy walks in. He's got thick black hair, caramel skin, and huge dimples. He went right up to the microphone and just started singing without doing any kind of warm-up. I was intrigued by this Cuban Frank Sinatra, but by now, the club had become really crowded and the dance floor was packed with people dancing salsa, so we decided to leave, as I'm not good with inhaling other people's sweat. That's why I don't do things like yoga. My fascination with Scott Baio had waned in the hours we were there because he was wearing high-top Reeboks. I told you, I'm very judgmental. The next day, I was still thinking about the singer. I called the club and found out that he performed every Wednesday night. Then I told Jackie that we needed to go back to El Floridita. The following Wednesday, we got a table on the floor, right by the band. And I just sat down when Jackie spotted someone at the bar. Isn't that Carlos? He was on our show. He had a few lines. I don't want him over here, Jackie. I don't want to be sitting with some asshole guy when Cuban Frank Sinatra walks in. Why are you such a bitch? What kind of guy comes to a club by himself? Jackie just rolled her eyes and got up to talk to Carlos. Meanwhile, Cuban Frank Sinatra walked in and started to sing. So I put my purse in the empty chair next to me because I didn't want Carlos, Mr. Fewline, sitting with us. Jackie had brought him over anyway. I turned my back to him completely, as if I was totally absorbed by the band. That is until I heard him tell Jackie, my friend Angelo's the lead singer here. I came to meet him. And with that, I turned around and said, Jesus, Carlos, how rude of me to turn my back to you. Eat something with us. As I removed my purse from the empty seat. Jackie, how rude are you? Carlos, please have some Platanos. Sure enough, when the band took a break, Angelo came right over to say hello to Carlos, who introduced him to Jackie and me. Do you dance, he asked. With you? Yeah. But I don't know how to dance salsa, I said. I'll teach you. On the dance floor, as Angelo's going 1, 2, 3, I'm doing the check. Smells good? Check. Dimples? Check. Good teeth? Check. Although the bottom row a little fucked up, but I found that sexy as hell. Strong arms? Check. Then the last item on the checklist. Shoes and socks. I was petrified as I looked down, because if you have white socks on, you're dead to me. Dead to me. There's no fixing you. You're beyond help. As a person, there are certain things you should know, and one of them is black pants, black socks, black shoes. Please, God, please. And he had black socks and good black shoes. Check! With Angelo, it was instant magic, like what movies are made of, songs are written about. But to be sure this magic was real, I needed to test it out. With my checklist complete, I decided to break the number one rule of dating, and I asked, so when are we getting married? Ha ha ha, he laughed. Ha ha ha, I mimicked him. It's going to happen, Angelo. I know you're uncomfortable in this moment because you're probably just thinking you're going to get laid, and that is going to happen right away. But here's what I'm saying to you. We're going to get married at some point. That's funny. I mean, I'm already kind of married. Suddenly, the romantic comedy movie that I was in came to a complete halt. What do you mean you're kind of married, I asked. What it meant, according to Angelo, and which I believed, was that he and his wife were legally married, but separated. I said, why are you married already? He said, well, where have you been? I've been waiting for you. Magic. I'm a sucker for cologne and a good line. What time do you get off? I asked. I was head over heels for Angelo with the dimples in a way that I had never felt. I wanted to be with him as much as possible, but it seemed that he could never sleep over. There was always a reason. An early work shift, or he needed to take his young son to school. If I had used an ounce of the life smarts I prided myself on, I would have known why Angelo could never stay the night and why we rarely met until late at night. When I look back on it, it's clear. I didn't want to know. After I had given Angelo a lecture about going after his dreams, he was selling electronics during the day and singing at night, which left no time for him to pursue his dreams of being an actor, he came to me and confessed the truth. I have to tell you something, he said to me one night. I'm really starting to like you, and I'm starting to feel bad about the person that I'm being. I'm not separated. I'm a cheater, and not just with you. I've been a cheater my whole life. This guy is so fucked up, and he's perfect for me. I admired Angelo's honesty and candor, and I think it made me fall even more in love with him. I didn't want to give him up, so even though Scientology hadn't helped me with my infidelities, I decided the church was going to fix his. I need you to go to this place and make a change in your life. Angelo did a small intro course called Personal Values and Integrity, which was about exactly what the title said. It discussed morality in a very simple way, stressing the importance of the participants confessing to any and all transgressions with exercises such as writing an essay on the topic, When Have You Been Dishonest? God bless him. I mean, Angelo threw himself into the course and began to tell me about every woman he had ever been with in the recent past, and there were a lot. Girls in the club, a dancer he knew from back in San Francisco, an entire bridal party. The more truths he told me, the more he wanted to tell. While most people might hear about these transgressions and be devastated, I had learned from Scientology that this behavior was not representative of the real person Angelo was. He just hadn't been cleared yet. All of this was still his reactive mind. A person could admit to the most heinous things and feel no remorse, but learning to admit to feeling guilt and to take responsibility was a whole other thing, which Angelo was now doing. We're taught to respect the person who has the balls to do that and admire him for it. Admitting you've done something wrong is the first step toward salvation, as defined by Scientology. According to LRH, each of us has something like 800 million overts, meaning transgressions, And you never get to get them all out in one lifetime, but it's being aware that you have them and need to work on them that makes all the difference. Angela's history with women was what the church calls an ethical blind spot. Every man he knew growing up, including his father, cheated. It was accepted. What wasn't okay was to leave your wife for your girlfriend. So for Angelo to finally admit to himself that he was, in fact, a cheater was a huge first step for him. And the fact that he was willing to do something about it was even more impressive to me as a Scientologist. This was someone who could confront things and make real change. Angelo felt like that perfect mix I was waiting for, a normal guy, not a Scientologist, but someone who could quickly get with the program and get with Scientology. My mom had a completely different take on the situation. "This guy isn't actually divorced," she said. "He hasn't even separated." Maybe it was the echo of her own situation with my dad and Dennis, who had both left her for other women, or that she wanted more for her daughter than being the other woman, but she showed a hardness with me that I had never seen before. For the first time, my mother, who had supported me through many things other mothers wouldn't have, expressed utter disgust toward me. "I don't even know you," she said. "I did not raise this person." My mother's reaction brought me back to my senses. Angela was married with 3 kids. I was so focused on his ethical blind spot that I had completely ignored my own. Suddenly, I asked myself, "What are you doing?" And the answer was horrible. I was destroying a marriage, which opened up a new blind spot. I had no real respect for marriage. What did it mean? Clearly, it meant nothing when it came to my dad or my stepdad, Dennis. And just as clearly, I had no respect for the family unit either. I went to the only place I had to work out my crisis of conscience, the church. I eventually and begrudgingly told them that I was having an affair with a married man who had a son with his current wife. I was told I needed to make up the damage. It was determined that the way for me to do that was to pay for Angelo and his wife to go to marriage counseling offered by the church. Scientology couples counseling is vastly different from typical relationship counseling. The church teaches that a marriage can't survive if one partner has any unknown transgressions against the other person. You need to reveal in excruciatingly specific detail what it is you've done wrong. Scientology doesn't factor in how much this kind of truth can break a husband's or wife's heart. Unlike other religions where one could relieve guilt by talking to a member of the clergy, Scientology forces its parishioners to confront and admit their transgressions face to face to their partners, no matter the consequences. So I did it. I told Angelo that he needed to give his marriage a chance, and the only way he was going to do it was through counseling, which I would pay for because of what I had done by sleeping with him. Although he was as sad about leaving me as I was about leaving him, he had realized the impact the values course had on him and knew that for the good of his family, he should give counseling a try. I felt no relief from making up the damage. Instead, I got to watch Angelo and his wife walk by me at the Celebrity Center where they were going to counseling, holding hands like newlyweds. My church was telling me, do not contact Angelo. And again, I was back in auditing and ethics to deal with my hidden, evil intentions towards men, which clearly had not changed. The church took little pity on me. On top of paying roughly $5,000 for the counseling Angelo and his wife did in the church, I now needed to meet with his wife in person and apologize for what I had done. I was beyond humiliated, but I also felt like I deserved everything I was getting. I met Angelo's wife at a coffee shop and stumbled with my words. "I don't have the answers. I can't justify what I've done," I said, unable to apologize, not because I wasn't sorry, but because an apology felt weird. "I'm sorry" weren't the right words. An apology didn't do it. His wife, however, had no problems expressing herself. I sat there and took my punches. I was dying of a broken heart, but Angelo never felt better in his life. After I met with his wife, he called me on the phone to thank me for all that I had done for him. "This is a whole new way of life for me," he said. "I never thought I could be honest like this. I mean, to look at my wife, tell her I've cheated, and have her still hold my hand. Oh my God, Leah, thank you." "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fucking hell." "You're welcome," I said. barely able to get the words out and pulling the receiver away from my mouth so he couldn't hear me crying. I hope you have a happy life now with your wife and your son, and I am sorry for what I've done to you all. I hope you can repair it. From that call on, I plunged into a well of despair, confusion, and self-doubt. Did I do the wrong thing by doing the right thing? Is that the way this love story was supposed to end? I guess it wasn't a love story after all. In the end, though, I understood what had happened through the lens of Scientology. The purpose of my meeting Angelo was to do penance for my years as a cheater. The pain I was feeling was my punishment, and I deserved it. I was told by the church that I must no longer talk to Angelo, so I didn't, and he didn't call me. I was still feeling pretty low several months later when Angelo called me out of the blue. I was shocked that he reached out to me. I didn't want to hear that he was happy. I was steeling myself for it, though. He told me he had some things he wanted to talk to me about, so we agreed to meet at a restaurant. After we sat down, Angelo told me about what he had been going through since we had last seen each other. The couple's counseling had been really therapeutic for him because, as he said before, it was the first time in his life that he was truly honest with a woman. But an unintended consequence of no longer being burdened by his own guilt was that he began to realize that his wife had her own set of issues and her own skewed set of values. Telling Angelo that he could still have a girlfriend, but he didn't need to leave her and his family to do that. He just needed to come home. But Angelo didn't want to be that guy. He wanted to be better. He was realizing that his own core values were changing as a result of his time spent in the church. But his wife's were not. Previously, he overlooked anything she did because of his own bad behavior. He'd been trying to make it work, but it felt like he was back to living a lie. He had already told his wife he was leaving. "So it's either with you or with someone else," he said. "But I want to be happy. I wanted it to be with me." Chapter 9. This was it. I was sure of it. This was going to be my big break. A sitcom in the time slot right after Seinfeld? It didn't get any better. When I got the lead role in the new series Fired Up, a mid-season replacement on NBC's must-see TV comedy block, I wasn't just thrilled, I was relieved. Finally, my chance. Finally, I will arrive home. Fired Up, which first aired in the spring of 1997, was exactly what I had been hoping for all these years. This was a sitcom with some serious pedigree. Kelsey Grammer of Cheers and its spinoff Frasier was producing the half-hour comedy starring NYPD Blue's Sharon Lawrence as a self-centered promotions executive and me as her mouthy assistant. Our characters quickly got fired from their jobs and were forced to move in together and team up to create a business as equal partners. Mark Feuerstein, who in real life is one of those really good guys, played my brother in the show. Since I've known him, Mark's proven himself to be a good friend and one of maybe five real men I've met in this business. Although we were getting an audience of about 15 million, which would be a monster hit these days, we were still losing about half the audience of about 30 million viewers who tuned in to Seinfeld every week. The network changed their time slot for the second season. With that, Fired Up lost its audience. Our last episode aired in February 1998. The death of that show represented yet another failure as an actress and as a Scientologist. At 27 years old, I was having to go back to the drawing board once again. There were so many starts and stops in my career, ups and downs, moments of triumph, and then heartbreak. It always felt like, this is it, and then it wasn't. Although that's the nature of the business in Hollywood, when it's happening to you, it seems like the end of the world. My failures in my professional life ended up driving me towards the church, which taught me that because I wasn't successful on a regular basis, I was doing something wrong in life. Being a Scientologist means you are responsible for all the bad things that happened to you, and anything good that was happening was due to the church. So it was only natural to assume that the cancellation of Fired Up was somehow caused by my transgressions or some technology that I was misapplying in my life. So when my agent Harry Gold called me about a new series for CBS, The King of Queens, about a blue-collar couple in Queens, I instantly came up with a reason that this wasn't going to work. I loved the idea of the show, but I felt America had left it behind and networks were looking more toward making sitcoms about young, sophisticated dot-comers. What's the point? I thought. I'm only going to do the pilot and it won't get picked up or it'll go to series and get canceled. My heart couldn't take it, so I passed on it. Harry swore up and down that this was my part, my show. Will you just meet with Kevin James? He asked, referring to the Long Island comedian set to play the part of Doug. It was Les Moonves, the president of CBS, who ultimately got me out of my funk. When he heard the news that I didn't want to meet on The King of Queens, he called my agent to say, "Who the fuck does Leah think she is? Passing on a show when she just came off some shitty show for NBC?" Oddly enough, that kind of honesty always cheered me up. I got up and showered and took the meeting with Kevin. Les Moonves was a real man I needed to work for. As soon as I walked into the room, Kevin took one look at me and said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Were you too busy not counting the money you weren't making on your canceled shows to make it to this meeting?" I was in love. Kevin had me crying from laughter in the first 5 minutes of our meeting. Some changes were made from the pilot to the series. The important change to the original pilot was the addition of the legendary Jerry Stiller as my wacky father, who moves in with Carrie and Doug after his third wife dies and he burns down the house with his lucky hot plate. Originally, Jerry, who perfected the art of crazy dad as Frank Costanza on Seinfeld, didn't want to do the pilot, but it was awful without him. When the show got picked up, he agreed to the part. We reshot the pilot, and it was like night and day. The concept for the show was simple. King of Queens was unpretentious and, most important, funny. Still, as I stood next to Kevin backstage on that late September day in 1998, waiting to be introduced to the live audience, I knew better than to take a single second for granted. The MC, the guy who warms up the audience before the taping, introduced everyone in the cast individually. Because Kevin and I were last, we had a moment to take it all in. I looked around at the back of the sets, which were just plywood over sturdier wood frames with jacks to hold them upright, and at the cheap staircase that led to the back of the kitchen set. There I saw a name and a heart engraved into the wood, a leftover from another set, another show, another time. "Look, Kevin," I said, "we should always remember that we're lucky to be here. There were shows before us, and there'll be shows after us. So let's never take it for granted." Kevin got it completely, and we looked up at that rafter before greeting the audience every single show. We're always aware of how fleeting this opportunity could be. And at the last show, 9 years later, Kevin pointed to that same piece of wood, but I couldn't even look at it. Even if we had wanted to forget that we could be canceled at any minute, no one let us. Despite the fact that we averaged about 12.7 million viewers our first season, thereby keeping 95% of the viewers from our lead-in, Cosby, and we hands down beat Conrad Bloom, which we were up against on NBC. "Sorry, Mark, but you did okay." Our success was called modest. We certainly weren't a critical success, that's for sure. The press either ignored us entirely or wrote pretty bad reviews. The performers are pleasant enough, and Miss Remini almost gives Carrie some zing, some guy wrote in the New York Times when the show debuted, but they can't overcome the stale setup. As for the title, there's no obvious connection to Queens, for which residents of the borough can be thankful. So yeah, we never really got too comfortable. At first it was, let's see if we can make it past the first 13 episodes. Then we prayed to get the last nine ordered to complete a full season. Even then, most of us said, we'll see if we make it to season two. The threat of cancellation always hanging over us actually had a positive side, though. Even if any of the cast had fights with the writers or complained about atrocities against humanity, like not having a sesame bagel, there was still an underlying appreciation for everything. Although I did more than my share of complaining, I loved King of Queens. I hate when people say enjoy it when you're complaining about something. I am enjoying it, but I'm also enjoying complaining about it. It's one of my favorite pastimes. I loved the audiences and the crew, but above all, I enjoyed the everydayness of the job. I never got bored of saying hi to the guard at the gate of the lot or seeing my name on my parking spot or listening to the latest from makeup and hair, the same thing, the same people, week in, week out. The routine was the part that I loved. I had a home, finally. And I had Kevin. who has ruined me for life. He was my first leading man, and despite doing other shows with other leading men, I've never found anyone who could compare favorably to him. When I was acting with him, I felt safe. I knew that no matter what the joke or the script was, Kevin would find a way to make it better. He was gracious, the kind of actor who would often say, "Give Leah the joke instead of me," unheard of in a town full of ego-driven males. Yes, we fought, like many married couples who were together every day for years, and yes, I treated Kevin just like I treated my husband, meaning I drove him crazy like any good wife would. And there were days when we didn't even speak until the cameras were rolling, but we always made up. If Kevin and I were like a true married couple, Jerry Stiller was definitely the crazy and wonderful father of the show. Kevin and I would constantly tell him, "There'd be no show without you, Jerry," and it was true. He was so funny, but he had no idea how funny he actually was. We would be in rehearsal, and Jerry would say his line and do his Jerry thing, and then Kevin and I would laugh and break character, and Jerry would just look at us like, "What's happened?" His wife, actress Anne Mara, was the same way, so talented and loving, and she would say, "You two are fantastic together," or she'd pop her head in my room and say, "You got the goods, sister." I miss her. When he was done with his scenes but still had to stay for curtain call, Jerry would take off his TV clothes and put on his street clothes, which were usually a tank top and pants pulled up way too high. Out he'd saunter from his dressing room in his backstage grandpa attire, drinking a martini, and would come by and say, "Jerry, look at you! What the fuck are you doing? Put a shirt on!" When he made us laugh, he always looked around like he wanted to know what we were laughing about. "It's you, Jerry," we'd say. He'd just lift his martini and shake his head. "It's you kids. You kids are the show." It's a cliche, but there was a lot of love on The King of Queens. The only time I felt a distance from other people on the show was when the topic of Scientology came up. I kept my religion very much to myself. Even though I had to go directly from the set to the church nearly every day, I didn't let anyone know where I was headed. If Kevin or any of the other cast members or crew invited me for a drink or dinner, I declined with one excuse or another. I didn't want people on the set to think I was weird based on the amount of time I had to spend at the church. As much as I tried to keep the different aspects of my life separate, everyone knew I was a Scientologist. And because of that, I still sometimes felt judged for it. If I looked at someone directly in the eyes or for a beat too long, they might say, "What, are you going to sign me up for a course now?" It hurt when people pointed out my quirks and acted as though everything about me was a manifestation of my oddball faith. I thought, couldn't I just be considered a diva or a bitch like everyone else? Why does it always have to come back to Scientology? On the flip side, I felt an added burden on set because of my Scientology outlook. If I had a bad day and snapped at someone or acted like a brat because I was given the wrong call time, I was guilt-ridden. The church would have frowned upon my actions, always pressuring me to set a good example, and that if I didn't, it might prevent someone from becoming interested in joining Scientology. I was never at a loss for reasons to beat myself up, and I worried about what bad effects my actions might have. As we went into the second season of The King of Queens, and the network decided to shoot the opening credits in Queens, things were looking pretty positive for our show. To take the whole cast to shoot the opener in New York was a real vote of confidence. I got to spend some time in Bensonhurst, then went to the San Gennaro Feast, an annual celebration in Little Italy that I used to go to when I was a little girl. It was a real hometown girl makes good moment. My dad, two half-sisters, and Angelo had appearances in the opening sequence. And on the street, the fans shouted things like, "We love you, Carrie," or "Where's Arthur?" It was loyal fans like those that got us a third and then fourth season, a huge milestone that meant the network had 100 episodes, enough to sell to syndication. Going into our fifth season in 2002, The King of Queens continued to dominate our Monday night 8 o'clock time slot, as we had done every season before, thanks in part to our comedy block that included Yes, Dear and Everybody Loves Raymond. Even the critics admitted that our show wasn't as unfunny as they first said it was. Variety, which in its original review wrote, "If only Doug and his show were funnier," now said that Kevin had the finest timing on television, and his couch potato humor is pitch perfect. Entertainment Weekly, known for its snarky editorial tone, called us TV's best comedy in its 2002 year-end issue. There was one hurdle King of Queens couldn't seem to clear, and that was winning an award. Any kind of award. Emmy had no love for us. No one, not even the sound mixing guys, got so much as a nomination for our show. We had a hit show, but it was a blue-collar show. But I thought we could at least get nominated for a People's Choice, whose ceremony aired on our own network. Can't you even buy these things? Was it really people voting? I mean, shows like Bed, which didn't even make it through a full season, won one. I'm a big fan of Bette Midler, but come on. I knew we were the People's Choice because I had people coming up to me every day saying we were their choice. Kevin told me not to worry about it. If you ever feel bad about yourself, Leah, I need you to go to Germany, he said. Swear to God, we're like the Beatles over there. As we went into our sixth season, it was announced that we were moving to Wednesday at 9 o'clock. In what EW called sitcom suicide, we were going up against The West Wing, The Bachelor, and The OC. But the best of all was our lead-in, 60 Minutes. What genius came up with that scheduling? When Kevin was asked about his reaction when he heard the news from Les Moonves, he said, I threw up and wet myself immediately. He turned it into a joke, but as we faced our sixth season with such a dismal time slot, no one was laughing. The nagging voice in my head that predicted bad things so many times, the one I worked hard to quell for hours each and every day at the church, either on course or in session, seemed to get only louder. Chapter 10. Inside the Scientology Ethics Office at the Advanced Organization of Los Angeles, the MAA looked through all my folders, which held every knowledge report written on me since day one of my life as a Scientologist. The system of knowledge reports is one of the major ways the church gathers intelligence on members. It is policy that you have to report on anything that is considered unbecoming to a Scientologist. Otherwise, you are considered complicit. As LRH described it, anyone who knew of a loafing or destructive or off-policy or out-ethics action and who did not file a knowledge report becomes an accessory in any justice action taken thereafter. The ethics review of all of my folders was part of the standard pre-check to be invited to do OT1, the first of Scientology's 8 operating Thetan upper levels. But before you can start in on this long and costly process, you have to undergo extreme scrutiny when an ethics officer reviews all of your church files that hold every one of your transgressions. My ethics officer, Julian Schwartz, didn't seem like the type to overlook anything. I sat on the other side of the desk while he thumbed through my files in silence. Most of the reports in my folder were of a similar nature. Leah threatened to have my legs broken. Leah told a student to go fuck yourself when that student complained about her wearing perfume. Off limits with the church, as scent can provide distraction to the people in the room who are studying. Finally, he asked, so, why aren't you married? It was 2002, and Angelo and I had been together for 6 years, during which we supported each other in everything we did, including Scientology. Not only was he on course, but he also understood when I went to the church straight after work and was there until 9 or 10 most nights. I don't know, I answered. It's not important. You don't think it's important to set a good example to the public? Does Angelo not want to marry you? Of course he would marry me if I wanted. Then get married, he said. I didn't know if I wanted to get married, but I was like, eh, if it's awful, there's always divorce. Scientology doesn't exactly put a premium on the sanctity of marriage, or on relationships between parents and children, for that matter. The church demands that rather than placing value in your own future, or your future as a married couple or a family, you place value and focus only back to Scientology. Divorce is rampant among church and sewer members, as is the dissolution of families. That night at home, I told Angelo what had happened during my pre-check and how it was suggested that we weren't married because he didn't want to marry me. After all the complications that attended the start of our relationship, sealing the deal was as simple as saying, make it happen, ma'am. On Christmas Eve of 2002, Angela and I went to dinner at a restaurant down the street from her house. After we were seated at a booth, he announced, baby, get anything you want on the menu. Oh, okay, Angela, thanks. When the waiter came, I ordered the calamari as an appetizer and the steak. Angela went into his pants and took out a wad of money. Let me just check, he said, peeling the bills off, because the steak is pretty expensive. Let's stop with the attempted comedy bit. Put your money away. You look crazy. You're the looks of the operation, okay? And I'm the funny. Let's know our lanes. Because when you step into mine, things go awry. All right, I'm going to the bathroom, he responded. But when he came back, he said, You're right about staying in my lane because I think I lost $100 doing my little bit. Angelo, he knelt down on the floor and stuck his head underneath the table where I was sitting to look for the money. All right, Angelo, get up. You look like you're going down on me. Get it later. No. We'll just get it later. Stop. Oh, here it is. Grab it, babe. God. When Angelo came back from under the table, he wasn't holding a $100 bill. He was holding a small black velvet box. Who ordered the calamari? The waiter interrupted. Bro, do me a favor. Can you give us a second? Sir, are you okay? Yes, man, I'm good, he said in Spanish, some mano mano shit and por favor. Oh my god, I was crying while the waiter tried to step over Angelo's feet to get to the table with the calamari. I took the ring box. I didn't ask you yet, Angelo said. I know. What's your answer? I don't know. Nobody's ever asked me that. Nobody ever asked you that? What? I don't know what I'm saying. What? You're asking me to marry you? Yes, baby. Oh my god. Did you order the calamari? The waiter said. Yes, we ordered it, Angelo said. Just put it down. On the night of July 19th, 2003, we got married outside at the Four Seasons Hotel in Las Vegas. It was, I kid you not, 110 degrees easy. VH1 was shooting our wedding for a special, so when they asked us to come up with a location for the event, I thought Vegas would be convenient for a lot of the guests coming from LA, as well as make for a fun weekend. I pictured all my guests tan and relaxed, from a day around the pool, looking and feeling sexy and elegant. What I did not picture was everyone, including me, melting under the brutal rays of a desert summer sun. I mean, had somebody told me, hey, dumbass, you know Vegas is boiling hot in July, I wouldn't have planned a poolside ceremony and reception. Instead, I put 125 guests through sheer misery. As Kevin told people, the best part was toweling off. Right before I walked down the aisle, I surveyed the landscape and the different buildings and saw what I thought to be a paparazzo on the roof of the building. Still looking to be accepted by the Hollywood in crowd, I was both delighted and disgusted. Paparazzi were a true sign of making it in this business, but what kind of fucking pig crashes a wedding? To get a picture on my wedding day? Man, Star Magazine must really want to get this exclusive. Emmy, here we come. People's choice. I can feel it in my hands. Kevin and I had arrived. Even so, this was not the place and the time, really. I called my security guy over and said, there's a paparazzi piece of shit on the roof trying to grab a picture of me, and I want him removed. Where? He said. Really? You have to get a better eye for these things. Right there. That guy, he said, as he pointed directly at the stalker pig. Yes, I said, obviously. That's your wedding photographer, he flatly replied. Oh. Motherfuck. During the ceremony, which I pared down to the most non-denominational 7 minutes of the Scientology wedding vows, and which was officiated by Susan Watson, the former president of the Celebrity Center, I looked over at Kevin, who gave me the wrap it up sign, which almost made me pee in my white lace G-string. Even though it was so hot that later I'd have to soak my feet in the pool, I was so happy to be marrying Angelo and to have all these people I loved around me to witness it. Most especially my mom, my sisters, and my friends, including Sherry, who had left the church when she was 21. Just like with my sister Nicole, Sherry's departure was a slow one. When she moved to LA, all of her friends were Scientologists, and she worked at Scientology companies just like I did. But the big difference was that she wasn't active in taking courses or getting auditing, while I was. Even after she left the church, she remained friendly with her Scientologist community and was still invited to get-togethers. You are allowed to be friends with non- or ex-Scientologists as long as they aren't antagonistic towards Scientology. If they are, you are expected to disconnect or break off all ties with that member, who is considered a suppressive person. A person is declared by the church to be an SP for a variety of reasons, which may include going to the authorities about the church or making any kind of negative comment about it publicly or in the press. Both are considered suppressive acts that can have devastating consequences for relationships. And furthermore, if the church were to find out that you remained in contact with an SP, you would then be declared an SP as well. Before Angela and I were married, his ex-wife sold a story to the Star magazine about her version of everything that had happened, including their Scientology marriage counseling. When the magazine hit the stands, I was called into the ethics office at Flag, where I was doing auditing. Some random Scientologist had written a knowledge report on me after seeing the article. Leah, either you disconnect from Angelo, or he disconnects from his ex. Are you kidding me? You're telling me Angelo can't see the mother of his son? How is he going to see a six-year-old boy? The ethics officer shrugged and said, I'm not telling you that. What does LRH say? The policy says what it says. Read it out loud, and you can make your own decisions. I loved Angelo's three sons, his oldest two boys who lived with their mom in San Jose, and his youngest in L.A., whom we had every weekend and certain days each week. Sometimes I got to pick him up from school when his mom was busy, and he was always a real source of joy in my life and had given me a wonderful taste of motherhood. Whenever the question of Sherry came up in one of my checks, however, I would always say that Sherry wasn't anti-Scientology, even though she was. Unlike many Scientologists, I didn't feel I had to give up every piece of information in my head to the church. I rationalized it to myself by saying that Sherry wasn't pulling me out of Scientology, which is the important thing. Since Sherry left the church, her life hadn't become a disaster, as we are made to believe by the church, far from it. She had put herself through night school, earning a hard-won degree from UCLA at the age of 30. Then she started her own tech business. She also married a nice, successful guy and had two sons. I never dwelled too long on that contradiction. The church's response to my question, well, how come that one left the church and they seem to be doing okay, was always the same. But are they happy, Leah? Truly? What about their eternity, Leah? Yeah, I thought her eternity might get fucked up, but they seemed happy and much less fucked up than me. Instead, I chose to focus on my own happiness. No sooner were Angela and I married than I was telling him I wanted a baby. But sex wasn't exactly fun for Angelo during this period. A typical lovemaking session between us kind of went like this. Babe, it's on. I'm in the middle of Sports Center, Angelo yelled from the other room. No, it's gotta happen now. In that moment, I predicted he had given me a girl. Angelo, who already had three boys, didn't believe it. But I was adamant. You've been so horrible to women your whole life that God's gonna give you one girl that you can't mess with, who's gonna wrap you around her finger, I said. I'm telling you, you're having a girl.